begin the question and answer session. And it looks like there's a veritable blizzard of questions. So. It's always encouraging. Question is, can you speak a little bit about samatha vipassana and explain the difference between serenity and equanimity? Thank you. Samatha vipassana is it's actually a commentarial kind of division that samatha is talking about tranquility, vipassana about insight, and it has a scriptural basis to a certain extent, but it was sort of as the commentaries tried to systematize the teachings and the methodologies, then there was a division into distinct realms separate practices of sort of samatha practices in terms of concentration, tranquility practices, and then vipassana practices, insight techniques, and I tend to lean much more towards that the Buddha himself didn't draw huge distinctions between the two, and also that my teacher Ajahn Chah didn't really teach in a way that drew large distinctions between them. Oftentimes he would say, like, samatha vipassana is sort of like, it's kind of like a green mango and a ripe mango. Same mango. So that's sort of, but it's a part of the process of the ripening. So that the aspects of concentration and settling the mind, one-pointing, creating tranquility within mind are part of the same process of ripening. And the reflective, investigative, contemplative aspects of the practice are part of that whole spectrum, the same spectrum of practice and training. They rely on each other, they depend on each other there. In order for the mind, the heart to ripen in relinquishment and liberation, then it requires both of these a proficiency in both of those aspects of training. the difference between serenity and equanimity. There's serenity is oftentimes used as a translation for the samatha or the tranquility, peaceful abidings of the mind. So that is more like a concentration practice. Equanimity, or the result of a concentration and focusing practice. Equanimity is a bit more nuanced in the sense that equanimity is both a Brahma-vihara, a divine abiding, part of the spectrum of loving-kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. So that those are sublime states of mind that are lofty they have a result in say a very refined state of consciousness. Equanimity is also an enlightenment factor, so that in the there's a set of teachings that the Buddha used, which are called the seven factors of enlightenment: mindfulness, reflection on Dhamma, effort, joy, tranquility, concentration, equanimity. So that equanimity is then also a factor of wisdom, in the sense of the mind becomes very stable, steady, unshakable, because of both it being, say, an emotional abiding, but also a wisdom abiding. So equanimity is a bit more nuanced. Serenity is probably a bit more just the settling of the mind, the peacefulness of the mind, and peaceful abiding. Could you please explain about the death process? What happens to us as we die, or as the body dies? How quickly does rebirth occur? Is there anything in those last moments of that life that affects how one is reborn? Our thoughts, our environment, or how are we being cared for, mature emotions, not so mature emotions, etc. Well, I think one of the things in terms of the death process that is really good to take into account is that when we think about the death process, we oftentimes, when we conceive of it in our minds, then it's sort of, you know, there I am in my bed at home, surrounded by my family and my loved ones, and then I mindfully pay attention to the death process. And in reality, what more often that what happens is either, you know, one is sort of like one is driving down the road at night and all of a sudden there's this headlights coming straight at you and it's sort of, oh shit. that's the death process. Or, you know, where it's completely out of our control, we're sort of carted off to hospital for some reason or other, and they fill you full of tubes, and then it, one is wondering, this isn't how I wanted it. So that, I think that's important to sort of put that into And because we idealize the how we think we're going to die. And you know, death can come quickly or slowly. It can come on our terms, and come not on our terms at all. And more often than not, that's what happens. So that the preparation for death is really reflections, investigations on a real day-to-day basis. And that's certainly what the Buddha, there's one of the chants in the chanting book that is called Abhinha Pachawekana. These are things to be reflected on again and again, sort of and the Buddha said, on a daily basis we should be reflecting on. I am of the nature to age, I have not gone beyond aging. I am of the nature to sicken, I have not gone beyond sickness. I am of the nature to die, I have not gone beyond dying. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. I am the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma. Whatever karma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. And those reflections on aging, sickness, death, impermanent separation, and being the owner of our karma, that is that is preparation for the death process, and it's exceedingly important to be allowing oneself to challenge one's perceptions of the illusion of a control, or the how long we're actually going to live. If we've been practicing for a bit, we usually get it that we have to die at some point in time, but it's usually off into the future. So that the reflections on death and the there's so many different ways of dying that we say what happens to us as we die. As we die, then there's a breakdown of the physical body. Of the processes that sustain life, and a breakdown of the on a certain level, the mind itself, not in the sense of you will all fall apart and go bonkers, but I mean there's what we conceive of as my mind and my thought, we prop that up through our whole life and identified with the thoughts, the memories, the perceptions, and that starts to unravel. And if what you've done is spent your life identifying with thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories, then it's going to be confusing because it's just natural that unravels, that's why there's the reflection in the morning chanting. Body is impermanent, feelings are impermanent, perceptions are impermanent, mental formations are impermanent, consciousness is impermanent, body is not self, feelings are not self, perceptions are not self. Mental formations are not self. Consciousness is not self. These are extraordinarily important reflections to investigate and to take on board, so that one is not identifying and building one's home in these impermanent non-self phenomena, which is the habit of human beings. And the rebirth generally takes place fairly quickly, in the sense that the mind identifies. There's a doctrinal position of the Theravadins that it's a sort of instantaneous rebirth. And I say a doctrinal position historically generated by after the Buddha passed away, and then there was various schools of Buddhism grew up. Then the Theravadins were one of them, and they had particular positions that they took, and one of them was this instantaneous rebirth. Which of course there is some scriptural basis for that, but there's also, I think, one of the wonderful things of the Theravadin scriptures is that they kept everything. The name, the Way of the Elders. It's sort of okay. They tried to keep everything. They were the conservative element, so that within the scriptures, then you also have things that contradict that. The antarabhava, which is the in between becoming, which is a state of which the Buddha talked about, and there's also a discourse where the Buddha talked about, compared it to like a fire being blown by the wind, so that the rebirth, so that as strong as the wind is picking up that flame or that fire and pushing it somewhere else, it could be longer, shorter, or further away, and then and compared that to, let's say, the desire, that to the degree of tanha and identification that impels the mind to rebirth, so that in general, you know, I don't think it's as neat and tidy as say that one. I mean, it's not as neat and tidy as the Theravadins put it, or instantaneous rebirth, or as neat and tidy as the Tibetans put it, where 49 days and it's like this. I don't think anything's neat and tidy. So that. But there are these processes that it's generated by, so that rebirth is generated by the identification, attachment, state of mind, and the degree of clarity and calmness within the mind, and that's why within Thai culture or Thai tradition, there's emphasis on people attending to a person who is dying, and supporting them, making sure they're comfortable, feeling a sense of ease physically and emotionally and spiritually. so that there be trying to remind them of, say, like using chanting, speaking to the person, meditating around them, spreading loving kindness to them around the sick bed. So that those are very supportive ways of creating a wholesome mental state, because that it does have an effect when the mind is in a wholesome state and is clear. It's also a time, those transitions are also times of opportunity as well, so very deep letting go. Seeing sort of, right, I've heard this, right, I'm of the nature to die, I'm not going to be, right, yeah, I've heard this before. And it's just, and so getting it, and then being able to really turn to relinquishment from a place of calm. It's possible. That's why it's support is there and encouraged, and say culturally, and it's also why that, say, after somebody, say, when we think of, rebirth instantaneous, it's also why there tends to be in all cultures really. A washing of the body, a ceremonies, ritual, so that it both for the people who are alive, but it's also for the person who's died, so that they can make that transition in a way that is with peace and relinquishment. So those are important aspects. And then there's also, of course, in the sense of sometimes somebody has built up so much habit or unskillfulness that, they can't really think of. There's a one of the monks, or former monks of Ajahn Chah's, was asking him, about working with, say, death and dying, working with people and giving them an opportunity for a wholesome rebirth, and Ajahn Chah sort of had his cane beside him. And pulled it out and just poked him in the chest and knocked him over and pushed him on the ground. And he said, Bhutto, 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 be peaceful. And he says, if somebody hasn't done the work, it's not that easy. So he said, that sense of the importance of preparation as we, through our life, it's really, that's His Holiness the Dalai Lama was one time asked, what was his practice? And what was his sort of the basis of his spiritual practice? And he says, I practice dying. That's yeah. As a guilt-ridden American, I can't quite comprehend how to respond without guilt when I've caused harm, even inadvertently. Could you walk through the non-guilt-oriented mental process of a person who has harmed or caused inconvenience to someone else? I'm thinking of the monk who falsely accused Sariputta. If that were me, I would practically have to leave the Sangha out of embarrassment and shame. Which is really answered in the way that the Buddha responded when that monk made his confession. So, oh, I falsely accused Sariputta, and I would ask for forgiveness. And that in itself, the Buddha said, it's recognizing one's faults as faults, one's unskillful action as unskillful action, and wishing to make amends, that is growth in the Noble One's Dhamma and discipline. And so that in itself is the difference. It's in recognizing that we all make mistakes, we all miss our shot, whether it's intentionally or unintentionally, and we have the opportunity to reestablish ourselves in that which is skillful, that which is appropriate, in accordance with truth. And nobody's really exempt. There's a difference between remorse in the sense of, okay, well, that, well, I really missed my shot on that, and saying, well, that was unskillful, because it is that is an impetus to change. It's sort of like the in Pali, there's a word called hiri and a hiri otapa. Hiri is a sense of a conscience, or a sense of a kind of embarrassment toward wrongdoing, and otapa is like a fear of wrongdoing. And it's very interesting when you say that in English, because that sense of, because early translators used to call it shame and fear. Shame of wrongdoing, fear of wrongdoing. And what comes up in our mind is pretty heavy negative states, but or associations. Whereas in the Pali language and by the way that mental states are structured, then those are extremely wholesome mental state. The mind is very wholesome. It's called in Pali, it's called kusala. And so that and intrinsic to a kusala or a wholesome mental state is a sense of well-being. A sense of well-being, a sense of clarity, a sense of discernment that's there. And so that having the clarity to recognize that's really unbecoming of what say it's not in accord with how I really want to be. So it'd be better for me to step back from that, rather than, oh my God, I did this. What are people going to think of me? I can't show my face anywhere anymore. And it's but because that goes spins around with me, sort of me and the problems I've created, me and my awfulness, and that in itself is the problem. The actual recognition of that which is unskillful, it has a very wholesome, protective quality to it, and also in the Pali language, when they describe that quality of conscience or shame toward wrongdoing, the underlying state of the mind is one of respect for oneself, in the sense that one respects oneself, therefore one does not want to do something which would be inappropriate or not in accord with one's values and one's intentions, one's sort of inner deep intentions. And the otapa, the fear of wrongdoing, arises out of respect for others. Because one recognizes, as human beings, we're in the same boat of being subject to birth, aging, sickness, death. We have a mixture of wholesome and unwholesome qualities, but there's a fundamental respect for other beings. So therefore, one doesn't want to harm anybody else either. It's a quality of respect that underlies it. So that as one tunes into that, then a quality of guilt is not really giving oneself due respect. It's undermining one's own wholesome qualities. So that's what a concept. That is really interesting to reflect on. And then the sense that from the Buddha's statement of the recognition of one's unskillful actions are the sort of the sign of growth in the noble one's teaching and training. It's the actions that speak louder, and they're the things that, rather than the perception of individuality, because that's what governs our sense of who we are, is actually a perception of individuality rather than a recollection of the intentions and actions that we attend to, and something that and what do we do on a more habitual basis? What do we do? How do we make our decisions? How do our actions get? There's very few people who are Buddhist meditators whose lives are committed to stealing and dishonesty and harming and violence. And, you know, it's pretty rare. But they say the perception is not in accord with the actual actions. So that it's important to sort of, and the perception, of course, is driven by this sort of guilt, oftentimes. So to be able to separate that out and say, oh, well, actually, yeah, I'm committed to integrity. I'm committed to that which is good. I need to really shrink back from the things that are unskillful. And then also, anybody can make a mistake, miss their shot, and one has the opportunity to recognize that and reestablish oneself on what is good. It's just like even the there's a time when the Buddha. There's actually several occasions, right, in the scriptures or in the Vinaya, where the Book of Discipline, where one would think, well, the Buddha really missed a shot on that, and one doesn't sort of come across, you know, the Buddha agonizing with guilt and struggling with the kind of the complications of that. It's a okay, that didn't work. Okay, we'll try it this way. And one of the things is also very helpful is an ability to recognize, okay, I really missed my shot. Asking for forgiveness, reconciliation. That's not difficult to do. It's very healing. Okay. How would you describe the jhana states, and do you teach this kind of meditation? That's pretty long. I mean, I certainly tend to. The jhana states are states of stability and composure internally that are a basis for very bright states of consciousness. And those are the states that the Buddha encourages. Because they lead to an energizing of the mind and a clarity of the mind that allows one to see things in their true nature, so that they're a very skillful tool. And I tend to follow Ajahn Chah's way of teaching, in that Ajahn Chah would describe the jhana states as a process of letting go, so that as you are willing to let go, to the extent that you're willing to let go, the mind settles very stably, very steadily, and I think that's very helpful, because oftentimes there can be a tremendous amount of desire generated for getting the jhanas, and then comparing oneself to those people who do get the jhanas, and maybe one doesn't get the jhanas, or one does get the jhanas, but then one's got to compare oneself with those it goes on and on. And to be able to recognize that the access to refined states of consciousness are most easily approached when we're able to keep letting go of those aspects of the mind that are obstructive. And as we keep doing that, then the mind actually settles. When there is a lot of pain in the body, it is difficult to maintain, quote, right effort, unquote. Yet sometimes, through patient endurance, the pain lessens or dissipates. Could you speak about right effort and the connection between right effort and samadhi? Well, I think it's good to refresh our memory as to what right effort actually is. Because when we conceive of right effort, often we use the word effort, and of course, effort is about doing, struggling, getting out there and energetically being assiduous and diligent, and which is good sometimes. But the way the Buddha defines right effort is that effort which is for the decreasing of unwholesome mental states that have arisen. That's right effort. And that effort which is for the preventing of unwholesome mental states that have yet to arise is right effort. And that effort which is for the bringing into being of wholesome mental states that have not yet arisen is right effort. And that effort which is for the maintaining of wholesome mental states that have arisen is right effort. It's a bit convoluted, but it's actually very, very clear once you get your mind around it. And when the Buddha defines it, it's all around the actual state of the mind, the mental states. It's not about, you know, how diligent you appear externally, or how much you flog yourself. That is about right effort. It's about attending to the quality of the mind, wholesome, unwholesome, and how you relate to the unwholesome or unskillful states, whether one supports them, buys into them, exacerbates them, and similarly with wholesome mental states. How do we encourage those wholesome mental states to arise, bright states of mind? How do we encourage them? How do we maintain them without clamping down or shutting down or worrying? That in itself is an unwholesome mental state. So the in dealing with pain, pain is a, it's really helpful to be able to pay attention and see the difference between the physical sensation and the mental association with pain. Because the physical on physical sensation of pain is oftentimes telling you something like, I'm tired, I want out of here, or something is stressed, something is, this is a warning dummy, trying to get your attention. So there's many levels of on the physical side. What is it? Some of it's bearable. Some of it's maybe isn't necessary to be bearing. There's something that needs to be adjusted or dealt with or ameliorated in some way. So that then, but then on the mental level, what is the reaction? What is the addition to it? What is the levels of fear or aversion that come? Because pain can be very threatening. And it can be all, it can also be very useful. It definitely gets our attention. So then there's an immediacy that can be there. So you can even use pain to really come up against it and challenge the mind, and challenge the assumptions that we have, bring a certain urgency to practice. So there's different ways. One needs to be balanced, and one needs to see, okay, what is a genuine kind of call of distress that needs to be heeded, and what is it that we can just be, say, patient with, or just to bear with the pain and then direct attention to the mind itself. Or sometimes with pain, just directing attention to the physical sensation of the pain. And sometimes one can absorb into the pain, and the mind can be very, very peaceful. And then it's like you can just be inside the sensation, and the mind becomes very cool and bright. And it's, there's many ways of responding. And it's a very interesting aspect of practice. But I mean, one of the things is having physical bodies, and we're always going to experience some sort of pain. And we can learn a lot about how much we expect, or how much we push, or how much we worry, or how much we fear. Through seeing our reactions to pain, and something that is very it's natural. Just having pain is a natural part of the human condition, and we do need to be just learning how to deal with it. With it skillfully. But I think one of the things is to actually sort of gaining confidence that pain can be worked with, and there's things that are can be. There's a point where, you know, the working with it is maybe backing off, resting, doing something. At other times, it could be just going into the pain. That's when I was for many years of my early monastic life, that was a fairly constant feature of meditation. Was this pain, illness, injury, and had the opportunity I had to use it. I had to become familiar, and I found it's held me in good stead. I'll do one more question. There's still a stack there. Tomorrow's another day. Okay. What is loving kindness? What is the body's and mind experience when I feel metta for myself and others? I think, you know, everybody's going to experience it in a slightly different way. There's not a formulaic way that you should be experiencing loving kindness. I mean, there's some general sort of parameters, but I think that base of loving kindness being a dwelling in non-aversion, putting it into a negative term, in the sense of rather than trying to count, because oftentimes in the Western cultural tendencies, cast things in an idealistic way. We're very good at ideals, so that ideally, what would be the perfect expression of loving kindness, and that's what we would try to get. And you drive yourself nuts doing it. So I think it's helpful to begin with a base of saying how to express it in a I think it's apophatic in its negative sense. A dwelling in non-aversion, so that it's the absence of aversion, of ill will. That recognizing it, okay, then you got something to fairly tangible to work with. And then, as there's an experience of the and recognition, because we don't dwell in aversion all the time, do we? And spend our whole lives in ill will and grumpiness towards the whole world, and then okay, building on that in a more positive sense, when it's translated into the Thai language, it's the way that it is expressed is a well-wishing, right? Wishing oneself and others well. There's this wish for their well-being, a wish for our well-being, wishing for others' well-being. So that there's this wish, aspiration, kind of hope, recognition that's what one would appreciate, that's what others would appreciate, their sense of well-being. So that I think that's a very useful perception of loving kindness. I mean, sometimes English language is so loaded with our cultural baggage. You know, how can I be loving towards myself and all living beings? I love everybody. Sometimes I don't even like them. But I can wish well. I can establish that sort of wish for my own well-being and others' well-being. I don't even have to like people to do that. I think it's casting it into a light that is sort of practical, realistic, and similarly that sense of sometimes using the words that are unfamiliar to us. That's like I think Bhante Ji sometimes. He'll play with language, with it, and it's like a friendliness or appreciative friendliness. It's not a word we use all the time, but it's trying to convey a particular feeling. So that as we, and of course as we, that kind of well-wishing or kind of an appreciative friendliness is the mental state, then internally there's within the mind there's a warmth, there's a spaciousness, there's a non-contention, there's an active concern for their well-being, and then of course physically there'll be a relaxation. Because aversion, ill will, contention, those have their attendant feeling within the body. I mean, there's agitation, there's tightening, so that physically one will feel a sense of ease, a sense of spaciousness, settledness. Physically, and then within the heart, there'll be a similar sense of openness, and there'll be space for oneself and for others. Okay, so those are some reflections. From, I appreciate people's questions, and I enjoy the questions. I mean, I never quite know what's going to come out when people present a question. So it's interesting to me as well.